Campaign that is all but announced. President Trump today, by the way, has gone on a new offensive. Over the weekend, he was talking about how we can lower the temperature. Now he seems to want to raise the pressure on the Justice Department and the FBI and those who he believes are illegitimately persecuting him. And he is apparently getting ready to demand the return of documents from the White House that, according to laws in the United States of America, belong to the National Archives. They do not belong. They are not the personal property of President Trump. All of this could also end up being part of a long list of investigations and lawsuits and political battles. And I wonder if the assumption that those battles, all of them in Georgia and in New York and in Washington, D.C. and in Florida and Mar-a-Lago, that all of the battles going on simultaneously about Trump actually help him and will make him more popular? Because how do people believe that even if President Trump wins the Republican nomination and wins election for another term, that any of this would stop? Bill Clinton illustrated the little episode he had with Paula Jones, where he allegedly exposed himself to Paula Jones. And I think it's a little bit more than allegedly, because he ended up paying, and this is true, $800,000 in a lawsuit that she had filed against him. And the Supreme Court decided, including justices appointed by Bill Clinton, the Supreme Court decided unanimously that President Clinton couldn't stop various charges that were brought against him and lawsuits that were brought against him, civil lawsuits that were brought against him, by saying, well, I'm too busy to deal with this right now. I'm president of the United States. No, that doesn't work. So even the election of President Trump a second time would, I know people say, well, he was elected actually a second time already. This would be the third time. All right, fine. I'm not, by the way, agreeing to that. But even if you take that position, the idea that these lawsuits would all go away is a fantasy. They won't. Bill Maher had a comment about how this entire episode could possibly and very conceivably help Trump. This is clip six.
His fortune was finally falling. The big lie was finally losing momentum. Mm. DeSantis was beating him in the polls. Mm. You know who hates this more than anybody? DeSantis. DeSantis, look, I had this in the bag, and now I got to run against President Martyr. Mm. And this is saving Trump politically.
Okay, could that be true? DeSantis has been very supportive, as, again, he would have to be to preserve his own political welfare within the Republican Party. Ron DeSantis was speaking at a Turning Point USA conference, and he condemned what he considered to be the weaponization of law enforcement. Listen.
These have now been weaponized to be used against people that the government doesn't like. And you look at the raid at Mar-a-Lago, and I'm just trying to remember, maybe someone here can remind me about when they did a search warrant at Hillary's house in Chappaqua when she had a rogue server and she was laundering classified information. I don't remember them doing that. I do remember them manufacturing a false conspiracy theory about Russia collusion. I remember that. That was not true. That was an abuse of power. I remember a lawyer for the FBI got caught doctoring an application for FISA surveillance against an innocent man. I remember the FBI, at Merrick Garland's direction, being sicked on parents going to school board meetings. Meanwhile, when you have a law that protects Supreme Court justices, is the FBI out there protecting our conservative justices? No. When you have violations of law where people are targeting pregnancy crisis centers, Are they doing their job and enforcing the law there? No. They're enforcing the law based on who they like and who they don't like. That is not a republic. Well, it may be. It's a banana republic when that happens.
Okay. Again, this is red-hot political rhetoric, but it's profoundly irresponsible. The idea that the FBI is allowing or sanctioning Molotov bombing and Molotov cocktails of crisis pregnancy centers, it simply isn't true. And the idea that the state of what was in Wisconsin doesn't care about that kind of assault. Wisconsin is a divided state politically. They have a Democratic governor, but they have Republican control of both houses of the legislature. And the one thing where, of course, DeSantis there makes a point that even people who don't agree with him on much of anything will agree that it is an important point is the comparison with Hillary and her situation. There's a long and very thoughtful piece by David French, and we'll link it to our website. It's basically about how serious it is if people are treated differently, and the apparent reason for treating them differently is political orientation. And David French, who's an outstanding attorney, he was a religious liberty attorney. He now writes for the Dispatch and for Atlantic and elsewhere. He says, we can't rewind the clock. We can only decide how to go forward. And so the DOJ should go forward with the same rule that applied to Hillary Clinton, including the same level of deference. Any other result wouldn't simply be unjust insofar as it would refuse to treat similarly situated people similarly. It would be profoundly destabilizing. There cannot be, writes David French, and he's right, one set of standards for Democrats and another for Republicans. Would applying the same standard mean Trump, too, should not face prosecution? Well, not necessarily. The available reporting indicates that Trump didn't simply remove clearly classified material from the White House. He also retained much of that material in spite of repeated requests that it be returned. Retained some of that material in defiance of a subpoena, and then ultimately treated the material as his personal property. It is not clear why Mr. Trump apparently chose to hang on to materials that would ignite another legal firestorm around him. But last year he told close associates that he regarded some presidential documents as his own personal property. When speaking about his friendly correspondence with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, Mr. Trump said, they're mine, regarding those letters, according to a person familiar with the exchange. Well, now, President Trump has gone farther. He's called on the FBI to return the documents seized at Mar-a-Lago. How's that going to go? And what are the other charges around the country? We'll get to that coming up on the MedVet Show.
Is the Michael Medved Show.
On Truth Social, which is the new platform that President Trump uses since he has been deplatformed at Twitter, he called yesterday on the FBI to return documents reportedly seized at Mar-a-Lago that he says are protected by attorney-client and executive privilege. Oh, great, Trump wrote on Truth Social. It has just been learned that the FBI, in its now famous raid of Mar-a-Lago, took boxes of privileged attorney-client material and also executive privilege material, which they knowingly should not have taken, Trump continued. By copy of this truth, they're not called tweets, they're called truths when it's on Truth Social. I respectfully request that these documents be immediately returned to the location from which they were taken, he added. Thank you. Is it likely those documents will be returned? It is very unlikely, and the reality is that no prior president and people who are horrified by the search of Mar-a-Lago are right. This has not happened before. But it has not happened before that any president of the United States has fought to claim possession of documents which in the Presidential Records Act are clearly attributed to the government. They're the government's property. And the whole idea of that is that when the president is working in the White House, when he is serving the American people, it is nothing is personal. It all becomes part of the record of his presidency. And the idea that Mr. Trump is now apparently debating that and claiming that some of the conversations, some of the correspondence that he had with his attorneys is covered by attorney-client privilege, that would be a unique perspective. David French, in the piece that I'm mentioning, where he talks about the difference and the similarities between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And one of the points that he makes is that Hillary Clinton got away with it. It wasn't the same thing. It was a different situation. In some ways, you could say it was a less clear-cut situation because what she was doing, which was inappropriate, and which may not have been a criminal offense, but it certainly was, as James Comey pointed out, a violation of basic rules that she, as a governmental veteran, knew something about. The idea that she went away with that, with no charges against her, no grand jury, no investigation, deep investigation, just a reprimand from James Comey, which, by the way, hurt her campaign, as did, of course, the James Comey coming up 10 days before the election, claiming that there were new reasons to investigate her emails. In any event, President Trump signed a written statement in June asserting that all the material marked as classified and held in boxes in a storage area at Mar-a-Lago had been returned to the government in June. Well, it hadn't. This misstatement, writes David French, could help explain why the Trump search warrant stated that it was seeking evidence of items illegally possessed in violation of both 18 U.S. Code Section 1519 and 18 U.S. Code Section 271. Section 271 prohibits removal, concealment, or destruction of federal records generally. While Section 1519 is an obstruction of justice statute, it imposes up to 20 years of imprisonment for any person who, listen to the language, knowingly alters, destroys, mutilates, conceals, covers up, falsifies, or makes a false entry in any record, document, or tangible object with the intent to impede, obstruct, or influence the investigation or proper administration of any matter within the jurisdiction of any department or agency of the United States, or any case filed under Title 11, or in retaliation or contemplation of any such matter or case. Trump, writes David French, lacks any real excuse for his behavior for retaining classified information. But Clinton had no excuses either. Remember, she used a private server to discuss matters that were classified at the highest levels, and she was seasoned enough to know exactly what she was doing. Trump's defense is as weak as Hillary's. His team is reportedly claiming that he had a standing order to declassify all documents that he took to Mar-a-Lago. But as Philip Klein notes in National Review, this argument is obviously absurd. And he writes in National Review, consider all the times that Trump was at Mar-a-Lago during his presidency and he worked out of there. Are we to believe that each and every document he brought with him to Mar-a-Lago, no matter how sensitive, was immediately disclassified? and thus widely available for people to see? No, that doesn't work. And if Trump went beyond Clinton in his effort to conceal and cover up the misdeeds, including defying a subpoena and falsely asserting that he turned over all the classified information in his possession, then he may face criminal consequences for obstruction, even if his initial misconduct wasn't materially different from Clinton's. I think that does as good a job as I've seen anywhere putting this entire matter into perspective. But part of the perspective that we need is to understand that it is just not a dispute over documents. The Washington Post, actually, and no, it's not the Washington Post, it's CNBC, the business station, that puts together a list of all of the investigations and lawsuits that Trump is facing on a range of issues. Number one, they list the federal criminal investigation into White House records removal. That's what's gotten a lot of publicity recently. But so is the Georgia criminal investigation of Trump for interference in that state's 2020 presidential election. And Lindsey Graham just got a court order. He has to participate. He has to honor the subpoena. The judge ordered Lindsey Graham to testify. That is going Fedward. Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis is presenting evidence and testimony to a special grand jury in Atlanta, impaneled to investigate Trump and a number of his allies in connection with their attempts to get officials in Georgia to undo President Joe Biden's election victory there. And then there's the federal criminal investigation into the Capitol riot. Another grand jury in Washington is collecting evidence and testimony related to Trump's actions leading up to the insurrection at the Capitol by a mob of his supporters. And then the Select House Committee, which will be back next month, investigating the January 6th riot. And yeah, it'll be back even if, as expected, Liz Cheney loses tomorrow. Then a federal criminal investigation and efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. That's false electors. And there's more. We'll be right back.
This is the Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, we're just going through the long list, and it is a long list. It's not just one or two or three. You're talking about seven or eight major investigations that are surrounding President Trump. Does that seem like a little bit of overkill? Well, each of them have their own issues. The federal criminal investigation into efforts to overturn the 2020 election. They report over at CNBC, Trump and his allies, including a team of lawyers led by Giuliani, engaged in a wide-ranging effort to reverse Trump's losses to Biden in seven swing states. The Justice Department is eyeing these efforts, which included a campaign to pressure Pence to refuse to certify Biden's win at a joint session of Congress on January 6th. Pence did not go along with the plan and certified Biden's victory in the Electoral College, guaranteeing that he would become president. Federal agents have seized phones from three men who had discussions with Trump at the time they were involved in the effort to undo Biden's victory. Representative Scott Perry, Republican Pennsylvania, had his phone taken this week. The lawyer John Eastman, who was one of the leading architects of a plan to submit slates of fake electors for Trump, previously had his phone seized. And by the way, how do we know they were fake electors? Because nobody had voted for them. It wasn't a losing electoral state. It was a group of people who had come forward after it had been very clear in their states that Trump had lost. There's also the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, who's a very partisan Democrat. But she is doing a civil investigation of Trump Organization business practices. And President Trump didn't want to, but he was forced by a subpoena to go and give testimony there. He was there for hours. He was there long enough to plead the Fifth Amendment. I refuse to answer on the grounds that it may incriminate me. The Fifth Amendment protects you from being forced to answer questions if they would lead to your conviction. So he's 440 questions he answered that way. Trump refused to answer questions under oath, invoking his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination more than 440 times. Trump's son, Eric Trump, who runs the Trump Organization with his older brother, Donald Trump Jr., in 2020 cited the Fifth Amendment more than 500 times when he refused to answer questions at his own deposition in the probe. Then there is the Manhattan District Attorney criminal case against the Trump Organization. This one is going to be one of the first to pop. The Trump Organization and its longtime chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, are awaiting trial on criminal charges on a 15-count indictment that has already been issued. They're now just awaiting trial related to an alleged scheme to avoid taxes on compensation to the chief financial officer and other executives since 2005. The defendants have pleaded not guilty. And then the weakest of all the charges against Trump, but it's still one he's going to have to deal with because it's a court system. Trump is scheduled to stand trial for a civil lawsuit in Manhattan federal court in February of next year. This is coming up immediately, well before his presumed announcement to be president of the United States again. He is accused of defaming the journalist E. Jean Carroll in connection with her claim that Trump raped her back in the mid-1990s. Carroll, in a 2019 article, said Trump sexually assaulted her in the dressing room of Bergdorf Goodman's department store after they ran into each other while shopping there. Trump, who was president at the time of the article, adamantly denied the charge that he had raped anybody and said Carroll was lying and motivated by political animus toward him to make up her account. The U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit is considering an appeal to Trump and the U.S. Justice Department of an earlier ruling by the judge handling the case. This gets very complex. Is going to persuade Trump supporters and MAGA believers and people who really loved, and there are people like that, good people, who loved the Trump presidency and wanted to return. It's not going to change their minds, no one of these things. But if you look at all of them, one of the things that damaged Bill Clinton's presidency profoundly was all of the charges against him and that led ultimately to his impeachment. And there is something wrong with a politician who has to step into so many controversies, some of which are very serious and involve serious criminal charges that can lead to years in prison. Neil Katyal, who's a former Solicitor General of the United States, a big liberal, he worked for Obama. But he said that if he were Trump's lawyer, he said, God forbid, he would be advising the family to prepare for President Trump having to go away for a while in prison. Do I believe that's likely? I think it's very unlikely. But I do think it will have an impact on the willingness of some people to try to risk everything to bring him back to the White House. And by the way, concerning the White House, there was a devastating report on CNN about Biden. Yeah, that's right. Biden attacked by CNN. Why? Because they're celebrating the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was so badly handled by President Biden. This is their 1 year later report, 2A.
So what this report does is it paints a picture of what it calls complete lack of proper planning by the Biden administration for this Afghanistan withdrawal. And when it comes to the big picture, it says that there were outdated plans that the Biden administration had start to draft in early 2021, even before President Biden made that announcement that the complete withdrawal would happen by September later of that year, and that some of those plans were outdated by the time that the withdrawal happened.
Okay, and it gets worse as they go into disastrous specifics. Listen.
At the height of the evacuation from that Kabul airport, there were 36 State Department officials on the ground who were able to process the Afghan documents to try and get on those evacuation flights. That's about one of those State Department officials for every 3,400 evacuees, just to give you a sense of the dearth of resources that they say were on the ground there. And they also talk about the fact that according to statistics that they were able to get their hands on, 25% of the people on those evacuation flights during that time out of Afghanistan were women and girls. Of course, that is alarming because there were concerns that women could be stripped of their rights if the Taliban took over. And of course, we have seen that bear out in some form on the ground there since the Taliban have taken over.
Okay. And again, there is a great deal of attention from establishment media, the Washington Post and the New York Times and the major networks about how horrible the takeover by the Taliban has been for the Afghan people. And the way that we withdrew, how the mechanism of our withdrawal actually erased some of the gains and some of the progress that America had made with its previous commitment under three prior presidents. It's a previous commitment to the people of Afghanistan. Okay, coming up, there's a U.S. Senate candidate, and this may be the Senate race that decides the election in Pennsylvania. And he's actually one of those candidates who may end up doing real damage to President Biden, not just by being a weak candidate, but with something else. And he's a Democrat. We will get to that coming up on The Medved Show. Michael Medved Show, the race for the U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania is crucial. Every Senate race is crucial because it's 50-50. The Democrats want desperately to limit their losses, and they'll have some, and then make up for that by taking a bunch of Republican seats. One of the Republican seats they have a real chance of taking is Pennsylvania, where Pat Toomey decided not to run for re-election. Mehmet Oz, who was endorsed by President Trump, actually won the primary. He is considered to be a very vulnerable candidate. And John Fetterman, the lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania, is running ahead. The problem is he's been sick for several months now. They write in National Journal, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman made his return to public campaigning Friday night. That's this last Friday, at a packed house in Erie, the preeminent battleground county in Pennsylvania. The show of strength reveals a truth about his current matchup with celebrity Dr. Mehmet Oz. Fetterman has a base that's fired up and ready to support him, while Oz's base remains skeptical. Oz has relentlessly attacked Fetterman for being in his basement and is holding event after event across the state. But the polls show voters are still backing Fetterman, who has been able to paint Oz as a carpetbagger in his TV ads. He's a carpetbagger because he lives in New Jersey. In a place as parochial as Pennsylvania, these hits seem to be sticking with voters. What also might stick with voters is if they pay any attention to the way that John Fetterman sounds after his stroke. And this is a problem for President Biden, too, because when you have a Senate candidate who is clearly not all there. Does it raise questions about President Biden, too, who is by far our oldest president? Well, it does, and it will. This is the way that Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman sounded on Friday night in his return to campaigning, a collage of his greatest hits. Listen.
And you can count on us to eliminate the filibuster if you come out and step with us. We will be able to stand with you in D.C. I gave away the lieutenant governor in Pennsylvania, the only lieutenant governor in the history to do that. And let's get some stuff done for America. Who would ever think that I would be the normal one in the race here, you know, with that?
It was, as they report, and everyone is reporting this, it was a tough debut for him to come back. And do I think that some of this will have an impact on that race and perhaps similar issues in the presidential race? There is much more in terms of the political map where we are trying to figure out what is going to happen next. But to take just a moment for a 10 years ago today, 10 years ago today, history was made. Felix Hernandez pitched a perfect game for the Mariners. Now he's not with the Mariners anymore. Of course, he's out of Major League Baseball. But there hasn't been a single perfect game, no hits, no walks to the other side. Nobody gets on base. You have just 27 batters. You get them out 1-2-3, 1-2-3 every single inning. That happens very rarely in baseball. There hasn't been a perfect game thrown in Major League Baseball since August 15th of 2012. And yes, long time ago. It sounded like this when Felix did it.
Seattle Mariners, Felix Hernandez, the 2-2.
He got him! 34 years, 119 games. It's finally happened. A perfect game by a Seattle Mariner. It was done by the king, Felix Hernandez.
The 23rd perfect game in Major League history.
Felix Hernandez. His name in a record box.
He does, and it's a great thing to remember. One of the key elements that is happening about January 6th defendants, there's several now who are trying to profit from their participation. A Nevada man who was jailed on riot charges asked his mother to contact publishers for a book he's planning to write about the Capitol incident. A rioter from Washington State helped his father haul clothes and other merchandise bearing slogans such as "Our House," like as in House of Representatives, and images of the Capitol. And a Virginia man, I love this, released a new rap album with riot-themed songs and a cover photograph of him sitting on top of a police vehicle outside the Capitol on January 6th. Now, they were folks who were true believers in what they were doing on January 6th, they refused to allow themselves to be prey. There's a series of movies called Predator movies. They're all about the same idea of an alien life force that comes to Earth to prey on people. And this one, well, it's actually better than its predecessors. It is called simply Prey. Listen.
Now it's time for MedVed's Entertainment Minute.
A young actress named Amber Midthunder plays a Comanche maiden 300 years ago, using her remarkable skills as a hunter to face down an alien predator that has landed on Earth in Prey. Now streaming on Hulu.
There's something out there. I'm coming with you.
You can't.
I'm trying to protect you.
Protect me from what?
This is the fifth installment of the popular Predator series, and the scientific elements, despite skillful special effects, are among the least convincing parts of the movie. What works much better is a haunting, respectful recreation of Native American life in the sparsely settled interior of the raw continent. The young and effective cast is almost entirely Native American, but a particularly charismatic canine star not only helps to save the day, but manages to steal the show. Rated R for sometimes eerie and disturbing violence. This is an impressive calling card for rising director Dan Trachtenberg. 2.5 stars for Prey. And again, that is streaming now. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be covering a report from Hotline that says we are expecting the most expensive midterms ever. A report from Ad Impact projects campaign spending in this cycle will be $9.7 billion, the most expensive midterm by far ever. And Marjorie Taylor Greene isn't wasting any time at all. She, in fact, has already filed articles of impeachment against Attorney General Merrick Garland. Now, Merrick Garland can certainly be fired by Joe Biden, but can a cabinet member be impeached? There are real constitutional questions about that. And the week is taking a look at what is very likely to happen tomorrow. All the polling shows that Liz Cheney, who is running for re-election courageously in representing the state of Wyoming. Wyoming only has a single congressperson, and she's going for re-election. The poll shows she's way behind. But The Week has an article that suggests she should run for another office. That office, a higher office than a member of the House of Representatives, that office being President of the United States. A good idea or ridiculous? We already have Andrew Wang, who has the Forward Party. Yes, they've just named his new third party. We can talk a little bit about Andrew Yang and some of the problems and challenges of third parties. And there's a piece that says 1 year later, life under Taliban rule is brutal and, in fact, nightmarish. And President Trump said over the weekend that he wanted to bring down the temperature. Has the temperature been brought down at all since the weekend, or does today, with demands of returning documents rather than taking responsibility for them, does that indicate the temperature only getting hotter in this remains of the summer? We will cover it all where it's still glorious. We still have baseball, still glorious to be able to do another day in this greatest nation on God's green earth.